Today is, what is today? December 17th, 2008, 8 days before Christmas. This is the third and final interview with Shar Tortorici. We're in my office, but we're still in the UW archives. My name is Troy Reeves, and I'm the head of the oral history program. All right, I want to start, as I said before I turn this on, with a couple of questions, follow-up questions from our previous interviews. So some are very technical that I think we need to get clarification on. Some are more cerebral. First off, you mentioned in one of the interviews before you and Dan were married, you had moved back here. You were living in an apartment. What part of town was that? Dan was living somewhere, you were living somewhere. So it was, must have been before you guys...
Before I got married, I lived on Fiedler Lane, which is on the south side.
Okay.
For a couple of years because my aunt and uncle were the Fiedlers. And they had apartment buildings and they needed help renting. So I lived with them for a couple of years. And then when Dan and I got married, we moved to the Isthmus.
Okay. So... is that where you were when Sterling Hall was bombed?
Yes.
Okay.
I was living on Fiedler Lane.
Okay. Now, I don't know if you're familiar with what that area looks like now.
Absolutely.
How does it look now compared to when you were living there?
Well, the South Side has not had a good run.
Mm-hmm.
It is certainly... Now, the buildings that my uncle built... are very sturdily built, and they are owned by a long-term tenant, so they are kept up beautifully. But the area itself has gone downhill, and it's really sad to see, because when I was living there, it was all young professionals, very few students. There were graduate students. We would rent to graduate students, but there weren't young kids, so there weren't drinking parties. There were... it was a tight little community, though, of young professionals, and it was... delightful.
Mm-hmm.
All the landlords kept their stuff up. All the apartments on Badger Road looked great over on Sequoia. I mean, it was a very, very nice area in the 60s. After they had taken down the Bush, the Italian neighborhood, mm-hmm. a number of Italians bought in that neighborhood, and the pride of ownership was there.
Mm-hmm.
Their houses were always kept up, and their gardens were beautiful, and it was a wonderful place to live. And you could, in fact, walk. It was a schlep, but you could walk from campus to Fiedler Lane, so in nice weather, you know, I could just walk home.
Mm-hmm.
And walking through the neighborhood was lovely. Would I walk through the neighborhood today? No. And it's very sad. My aunt and uncle's buildings are still beautiful and still kept up well and still always rented. But the rest of the neighborhood, I know they're trying. They're trying to bring it back, but it's not there yet.
So was there a, it's a very vague term, but was there a sense, when you were there, even though for the brief time you were there, was there a sense of community?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I knew everybody. You know, we rode the bus into campus together. You know, I was the baby because I was an undergrad. But the graduate students would come, or if they were state workers, number of hospital personnel that would take the bus with me and get off at St. Mary's or get off at Methodist downtown. Meritor wasn't built yet. But it was definitely that. And we'd go caroling at Christmas. And, you know, it was wonderful. And you kind of wanted to go caroling at Christmas to see how everyone had decorated their apartments. And everything was really quite upscale. And then the South Side declined.
Okay. I didn't have for sure where you lived. That's why I wanted to make sure I get that. And then I'm always interested in where a person lives and how they feel about it. I mean, sometimes it's a community and sometimes it's just sort of a place.
It was lovely. In fact, I always thought we would buy a house on the South Side. You know, when I was living there, I'd walk through various neighborhoods and say, now that's the cutest little house I ever saw. You know, wouldn't that look cute with two cats in the yard? You know, and having a garden. But by the time we bought a house... there was no way you would ever buy on the mm-hmm. South Side if you could avoid it.
Mm-hmm. How long did you and Dan live on the Isthmus before you moved?
Oh, a long time. We lived on the Isthmus from 1971 to 1990, essentially. There was one break back to the south side, just because the apartment was so fabulous. But our first two rental apartments, first three, were in the Isthmus, and then we were a year on the south side, and then we bought in the Isthmus. So most of the time we were married up until we bought our current house in 1990, we were in the Isthmus.
Okay. You lived in multiple places in the Isthmus, but were there, the places you lived on the Isthmus, was there a sense of community?
Yes, absolutely. We knew all our neighbors. We were, and in every place we ever lived, we always had a sense of community, and we always lived in a flat. So certainly the other people that lived in the house were our closest community, but then we actually rented from the same landlord the whole time we lived in the Isthmus. He owned a number of properties, and we all became a community, the people who all rented from him. But we knew everybody, we've always felt like we were very much a part of something bigger.
You mentioned graduate school a couple of times, and in one of the previous interviews, you mentioned when you got into graduate school, it was a smallish class, and then it even funneled into a small cohort of, I believe, four people, including yourself.
No, there were four blocks, and there were eight in each cohort.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. Well, then I believe you mentioned a few of the people that you were closest with. You mentioned a couple of men, and you mentioned a woman, and you mentioned her first name, and you couldn't remember her last name.
Oh, and I remembered it. And then I forgot. Mary Jo. Oh, shoot. I woke up in the middle of the night remembering it. And now I have forgotten it again. Mary Jo. If you give me a phone, I can call Jim Hansen. He'll remember. He was one of them.
Maybe we'll do that if it doesn't come to you in the next... before we wrap
this up. I should have written it down.
I'm just checking off what we have here. All right. The rest of these questions, at least that I have, specifically deal with either academic staff or governance or the combination of the two.
Okay.
So, I'm going to try to do these in some sort of chronological order, so let me... Okay. You mentioned a couple of ways that MASA academic staff tried to influence folks before the legislation was passed, and that was evaluating the committees and trying to educate faculty, students, legislators about what academic staff is.
We're still doing that.
were there other ways? And actually, there's a question about that too. But right now, so during that time period, were there other ways besides? Besides reevaluating committees and educating, that you were working to try to get shared governance?
Don't ask me why, but for some reason, Chancellor Shane had an academic staff advisory committee, and he called it the Academic Staff Committee, ASC, and it was only advisory to him, but he did convene it, and we did meet monthly. So there was the ear of the chancellor. I think that came down from system that it would be a good idea for all chancellors to have that because they were getting pressured as well. There was a lawsuit in Stevens Point about that time where a bunch of academic staff that were teaching academic staff did a class action suit and sued for tenure because they didn't look any different than the tenured faculty. Mm-hmm. And I believe that lost. But by the same token, there was some rumblings about that. So I think that's where that idea came from. But it was helpful. It was helpful to meet with the chancellor every month and to, get our concerns in. But I think more importantly, it showed upper-level administration that these were not harebrained, crazy people. These were truly professionals who cared about the institution, who could talk about the scope of curriculum, scope and sequence. They could talk about graduation requirements. They could talk about how to build a library collection. There were people in every walk of life, and they could talk about how do you make the summer orientation experience the best possible? What do students need to transition successfully? All kinds of things. Suddenly, there was a wealth of expertise that I don't think they realized was out there. And we could showcase it. We were discussing the same things that the faculty and the faculty senate were acting on. We were very much a part of that. And so they saw that we weren't going to take over the university, because we, of course, were twice as many people as the faculty. But when they saw us playing the same game and with the same rules, I think that went a long way. We had some top-level administrators on those academic staff committees, the advisory ones, and some of them had faculty status. That was a term that was available to some people. And there was one Senate district that was made up of everyone with faculty status. And those folks were always respected. But then as you added people who did not and were told they could never get faculty status because they were letting that go, as more and more people got involved and they could see that, hey, they're not any different than those who were awarded this, benefit.
Was there fear or perceived fear of academic, and they meaning faculty and to a certain extent administration, which most of the time was actually faculty.
Oh, absolutely. Who had just been,
was there fear of academic staff taking over? Did that have any linkage to the basic sort of student protest movement in the 60s and 70s?
Well, I think it probably did. They would not say that because that sounds silly. But I think it probably, these people look more like those TAs that were radical. A lot of these people are that age because, in the 60s and 70s, as academic staff were proliferating, that's who we were. That was the age we were. And there was a group called SOS, something specialists. I forgot what the S and the O stood for, but they were quite vocal. Almost all academic staff at one point were called specialists, and this one group that were pretty much research, they had PhDs, I think they were pretty much the researchers, and a few of the instructors did make waves. Now, that was 75 through 77. I wasn't on campus. I only heard stories. And they made waves like, let's go picket this meeting. So it had, it harkened back to the bad old days. And I think there was some fear that, academic staff might get real feisty and try to do something in a political arena that would not look good for the university.
And I suppose this, did you have
Well, I was going to say, and we certainly can't just open the door to them because they'll outvote us. We knew that fear. You can't just open the Senate and make it an academic staff and faculty Senate, because if the rule of one senator per 10 held, you would have a huge Senate. But if you change the rule to say 1 in 50 or 1 in 75 or something, then you've got, a second class group, and what will happen there? Mm-hmm. Although the Academic Staff Assembly is in fact structured around assembly districts that run 75 to 100 or so. So, we did that to ourselves. Mm. But.
Also during this time, and we've talked about this in the first interview, but not in this sense, I don't think. In the 70s, the TA, the Teachers Assistant Association, they not only struck in 1970, they were also, I think, striking or at least having negotiations of that throughout the 70s. Mm-hmm. So again, I guess I'm asking you to speak for faculty and administration again, but do you suppose they also saw that tied, that the Teaching Assistant Association was also tied to academic staff?
No, I don't think so.
Okay.
I don't think so. I don't think they were, and they weren't. It was just another group that was, because the TAA really was a union. The academic staff were not asking for a union, although there were many who felt that maybe we should look at that model. But that didn't... The Madison Academic Staff Association did do a survey in, I think, mid-'80s that asked, would you support a union? And it was 51% no and 49% yes. And, you know, could have gone either way based on who turned in those forms. So I think that was a little bit of a concern to the administration. Well, maybe they'll unionize. That in the intervening years, that has become almost a scary thing because unionization of academic staff and faculty would, of course, decouple the two. The way the bills are being written right now is that if we got collective bargaining, faculty would bargain separately. Well, that means academic staff would never see raises in our lifetime again, you know? So it's become, even though I was very pro-union and would have supported collective bargaining back in the day, I would never have supported decoupling. You know, we always thought it will be a Madison campus bargaining unit that's faculty and staff. Well, that's not how it's being written, and that's not how the faculty have said they want it. Years ago, it was. They wanted a single unit just to get it passed, but that has changed.
Shifting gears slightly, you talked and sort of laughed about it, that you're still educating faculty and administration about what academic staff. So I don't think I've asked this question directly, so... What is academic staff? And then the follow-up. Yeah. And I hate to ask two questions at once, but why is it necessary?
To be academic staff?
To have, on a campus, to have academic staff.
It is not necessary. You can have the whole untenured faculty like we used to be. You could have an unclassified. Mm-hmm. So what you call them is, you know, somewhat arbitrary. But you do need those professionals that are specializing in library work, advising, administration, admissions, registrars, the health service people, the testing people, you know. There is a whole bunch of professional services that are required at a campus, and many of the other campuses consider them faculty positions. But some will offer tenure along with them, many don't. That it is a non-tenured, but it still is considered part of your faculty. So the fact that we are called academic staff is unusual. It's an odd term. Most people don't understand it. And what I find fascinating is the first question Chancellor Martin asked when she went to the assembly was, how do you define yourself to academic staff? And they tried to respond, and she said, I want you to come up with a good answer. Their answer was to do a wonderful, and if you get a chance to see it, DVD on what is academic staff. And it is just people in front of the UW crest talking about what they do. And there is a lecturer that is in criminal justice. She's handcuffed. It's very funny. It's very well done. There is the guy who actually did it, the videographer, mm-hmm. And... You know, hi, I'm also academic staff. There was somebody named Dean who worked at DoIt. He said, hi, I'm Dean from Instructional Technology. And then it showed the Dean from Academic Services in the School of Education. And mm-hmm. the next segue is, and I am a dean, mm-hmm. you know. Mm-hmm. So it went through a number of those professional jobs that provide the infrastructure that allow the faculty to do what they do best, teaching, research, and outreach, and they don't get caught up necessarily in some of the other things that could drag them down from their perspective. And yet, from the people who do it, it's the joy of their job. So academic staff really are not students, not faculty, not administration, not regents. We in the if you look at the state statute, it's pretty much, you know, D, none of the above. You know, that's sort of how we're defined. Mm-hmm. But it's the professionals that are unique to higher education, but are not the other folks.
So, just to clarify, was the DVD in answer to Chancellor Martin's...
Who are academic staff? How do you define yourselves? And it just debuted December 8th, and I'm not even sure they're completely done with it, but they showed it at the assembly, and I happened to be there, and it's very, very well done, and it gives you the breadth of what academic staff jobs are. Does it answer the question, how come some of these are not faculty? Like, the instructor in the law school, you know, why not a faculty position? Well, therein lies part of the problem. We have three categories of academic staff, A, B, and C. The A are what I'm just defined to you, the professionals that provide the infrastructure. The B are folks that look exactly like faculty. There are instructional folks and there are research folks, many of whom have the terminal degree. And category B was created to provide short-term personnel for something, like a 10-year grant. And so you would hire at the same qualification level as you would your scientist. You might hire a, you know, research person, or might even hire a scientist. If you know that your incoming freshman class is going to be huge and you have to teach those service courses, you could go after a faculty associate in English, math, and chemistry, those other service courses. But the intent was that that would look more like a postdoc, and those folks would ease on down the road after the grant was over or the bulge in the class was over, and they would get faculty positions elsewhere. However, that category of personnel is very successful. Many of the scientists went on to get their own grants, multi-million dollar grants. So you don't let those people go. You can hang on to them as long as you can. And when departments looked at tenure density and at these teaching academic staff that do a superb job because they're not pulled off doing the other things, they didn't want to give up those folks. So suddenly that category B has created some problems because it was successful, and they have made successful careers in category B when at merger it was set up to be more of a revolving door than it is. The category C are the limited, serve at the pleasure of, and you know, you need to have that. Those are the ones that you don't want job security rules to apply to, so you know you're taking a chance. I'm appointing you. They're usually high-level administrators, mm-hmm. You know. And if a new chancellor comes in, you're probably gone.
Which is what we've seen recently.
Yes, indeedy.
And may see a little bit more of before everything settles.
I think we'll see a lot more of it.
What were masses or our academic staff's goals after the legislation passed?
How did we want to merge in with governance? We wanted to be part of the committee structure, which I think we have done a very good job. From a standpoint of university governance, I think academic staff have been very successful. We are on most joint committees. Do we have parity? No. But we are on, I think, almost all university committees. We have the assembly, which does frequently take up initiatives that mirror what the Faculty Senate's doing. We have the ear of the chancellor and the provost. That's working very well. We also wanted inroads into departmental governance. Particularly the instructional and research people wanted to be part of the executive committee decisions. That's spotty. That is really spotty. On the school and college level, every school and college has a committee on academic staff issues by legislation. You have to have that. So we're doing okay. University-wide, we're doing quite well. School-wide, we're doing pretty well. Departmental and unit-wide, not so well. There hasn't been that opening welcome. You know, yes, you can be part of it. Some of the departments are great and do have academic staff. Their long-term staff participate, and you can't tell who's who. But most of them know. If you're academic staff, you probably don't sit on the executive committee. You may or may not have a vote on general faculty things. You are probably allowed to sit in, but you don't participate as much. Units are a little different. You know, I've always worked in a unit, so and of all academic staff. We had faculty directors, but their directorship is an academic staff position, and so it was easy. You know, when you have units and you're all academic staff, you govern. You know, as long as you're not top-down administration, as long as people have input, you've got your governance there, and probably always did. But the academic departments are still a little bit off limits.
Do you foresee them ever being?
No. Not my lifetime. I really don't.
Mm-hmm.
And as we look to more and more part-time staff, it makes it worse. You know, when the campus is getting better about being flexible to meet people's lifestyles,
mm-hmm.
so we are getting academic staff that are 50%, 70%, sometimes in some departments like kinesiology, where they teach all kinds of sports, they have just a plethora of people that are at 35% or something. And they really are somewhat disregarded. And if you can disregard somebody at 35%, it's pretty easy to disregard 100% person as well.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't see that that's a good trend. But maybe someday, I just don't see it.
Did you personally help to shape some of these post-legislation goals, getting involved, getting academic staff on committees?
Oh, absolutely. I spent 12 years of my life on the nominating committee at two different six-year shots. It became very important to make sure that the committees were staffed with people who were top-notch quality people. And sometimes that was a surprise. I don't know if I told you this story, but David Ward called me as chair of the nominating committee once and said, you put forward two names for the library committee. And he said, they're very different than he said, I know both the people, and they're very different from what the faculty put through. The faculty always put through people who have an agenda, who want the library to go in that route. And I said, I know. That's why we put forward two generalists who know library systems but are not coming with their own agenda that can look more broadly at it. We did that very purposefully, and we went after two people that we knew could provide that. And we think you need the balance. And he said, do you think it's untoward of me to challenge your nominations? And I said, you're the chancellor. You can do whatever you want. And he was very funny. He wasn't the chancellor. He was provost at the time. He called me back about 2 years later. And he said, I want to apologize. Those have been the best committee members. They have helped the library committee see that they can't be, you know, a pit bull to push forward somebody's agenda. They have to look at the whole university.
Mm-hmm.
So he recognized that what we were trying to do really does work. And we now have some procedures in place where we will call the committee chair and say, what kind of balance do you need? How can you make the committee better? What kind of a person are you looking for? How can we help? And we will go after people that will benefit a committee.
So you speak with the academic staff co-chair, or you speak with the faculty?
There are no academic staff co-chairs.
That's
they are
I
not
thought.
Allowed. We talk to the faculty
okay.
chair. If we disagree with them, we'll go after whoever we want. Mm. But you know, and we'll get a sense of what the committee's doing and how it's... all committees present reports, so you can go back and say, well, this committee was pretty myopic. I think we need somebody that's more of a generalist or whatever. But there are procedures in place to try to do the best we can. I know that sometimes the faculty model is just put somebody on there who's willing to do it. And that's not our model.
it shouldn't be. But that's my, yeah, it's my opinion. This is a question that you've probably answered indirectly through various other questions, but we'll ask it directly. So after the legislation was passed, why stay involved for the, you know, now, what is it, 23 years since the legislation's been passed?
Because I don't trust anybody else to do it right. I had a vision, and I want, in fact, I'm more involved now than I would have thought I would be in retirement, planning the Academic Staff Leadership Institute, and still on the MASA Steering Committee. I never in my dreams would have believed I would still be doing that in retirement, but I think we've gotten sleepy, and we got to set a fire. Or we will essentially lose by atrophy. We'll lose our governance rights. Because if we're not doing anything meaningful, people are not going to be showing up at meetings. They're not going to take committee work seriously. And we are seeing in Chancellor Martin a different model of relating to governance. A little more distant, a little more top-down. And that does not bode well for academic staff. So we need to be doing more educating. We need to make sure that the gains we've made aren't lost.
So that's something you can see, even though she's basically, this is finals week of what would be her first semester on the job. And this is something you and perhaps other sort of academic staff who pay attention to these things, you can see this already.
Yes.
In a previous interview,
who's going to listen to this?
I will turn this back on. I only have a couple questions left.
Okay.
The
Wilkinson, Mary Jo Wilkinson. I knew it would come.
That's great. Of woman. It's Mary Jo Wilkinson.
Yeah. Recently retired.
You will be able to sleep better
tonight. I will.
Okay. In a previous interview, we talked about after governance that some campus academic staffs have flourished while some have not. Do you remember saying something like that? Did I mishear?
I don't remember saying anything like that, but I'm wondering if I wasn't referring to the departmental governance piece.
And it could conceivably be something like that.
The other thing is I may have been referring to some things. There are still many, many academic staff that will get hired on this campus and get lost. That's another piece. If you don't get active in something, whether it's a professional association or whether it's a social group of some sort, it's very easy to come to work and only see your immediate colleagues and go home and think that's the whole world. We're realizing that MASA, for the last couple of years, has tried to see the campus sites, you know, campus treasures, and introduce people to places. Like a carillon tour. Mm-hmm. There are people that don't even know we have a carillon. You know, if they can't hear it and don't see it, they don't know it. Mm-hmm. They don't know we have a print tandem press as a internationally known print facility. They don't know about the 13th floor of Educational Sciences with one of the best views of the city, or glass blowing. You know, the Geology Museum, a lot of people have never heard of it. Mm-hmm. So even something like the Chazen that is nationally, if not internationally known, some of the collections are so valuable. Some people, they all know it's there. Some people have never been inside. So, you know, we've had a couple receptions there with then a tour with mm-hmm. Russell, the director, just to introduce staff to all the amazing things that are here. It's easy to get lost. The mentoring program was pretty much developed specifically to help staff find ways to get out and get involved. If you don't get out, get involved, and poke your head up above your desk, there's a good chance you will be doing the exact same thing 30 years from now that you started out doing. One thing that you hear routinely that breaks my heart is, well, my supervisor never told me that, or my supervisor never said I could do this, that, or the other thing. Well, did you ask? You got to take responsibility for your own career. And I see staff not doing that routinely. And then 20 years in, feeling very isolated and very undervalued. We don't have necessarily good supervisors on campus. Many of our supervisors are faculty that might even be in absentia because they're on sabbatical, or they're flying all over the world giving talks, or they're very burdened academic staff members that just don't know how to be a good manager in terms of promoting someone's own personal professional development. And so you got to do it yourself. And I think we have a lot of people that get lost because they don't. And that could be something that I meant as well. I don't know.
Mm. Okay. I think both of those answers expand on the comment that was made. So, my last question, and then I'll leave you if there's anything you feel you need to say. But is there shared governance?
I heard a snippy comment by a well-placed administrator that said, faculty govern, academic staff share. I was so mad, but I think that's accurate. There is shared governance, but it's not equal shares. Should it be equal shares? I don't know. I think it should be a stronger percentage to the staff. But, you know, faculty purview still is over curriculum and the instructional piece. But there are parts of the university, a lot of it, that should be better shared than it is.
Is there anything you would like to mention, discuss? I believe this will be our last interview, so.
Can't think of anything.
Okay. Well, I want to thank you for the time you've given me over the last few months. We had sort of our own little sabbatical between October and December, but I appreciate it very much. Thank you.
Okay, thank you.